Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. We have another special guest this week in Kevin Muir, who is owner and head of investments of his own proprietary trading fund called Wintour Capital in Canada. After a successful career as a derivative trader for the Royal Bank of Canada, Kevin foresaw the upcoming tech bust in the early 2000s and used this opportunity to jump out of his corporate life and has been successfully running his own capital for the last 20 plus years. He details his thoughts on the markets and macroeconomic themes through his popular daily newsletter, Macro Tourist. Damien.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. The main reason we wanted to get Kevin on, not only because he often has, you know, quite interesting and important viewpoints on the market, but he's probably got one of the best credible inflation increase theories there are out there. There's a number of people out there who have been talking about the whole, you know, inflation's under your bed, it's just about to jump out and get you, all this QE, there must be a payback and all that type of factor in it. And it's sort of lost in this whole debt deflation issue, and they're sort of ignoring that issue and just focusing on yeah, it's there, it's going to come at some stage, we just, yeah, just look out. Yeah. And we haven't been of that view, whereas Kevin has got a much more credible sort of take on from our perspective, a much more credible take on what would actually cause inflation to come back. And so we thought as well with talking to him, because we agree on a lot of things, and it's just coming back to that point about when and what. And so that's why we got him on today.
Absolutely. And after the interview, as always, we will be looking at some of the wider investment implications and how these themes can impact how we invest money every day here at Nucleus Wealth. And just a reminder that we have pre-shot today's interview, but we are available right now live to answer any questions at the end of the recording. And just as a note as well, we are always open to any guest or topic suggestions, so feel free to drop a suggestion our way. And as always, please take a moment if you'd like us on YouTube and follow us on your preferred podcast platform and all your social medias. So we'll run the tape now, and I hope you enjoy. Today on the show, we have trader and author of the popular daily newsletter Macro Tourist, Kevin Muir. Welcome to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Great to be with you guys today.
Fantastic. So, Kevin, just to get our listeners up to speed, would you mind providing a bit of a brief background on yourself and Macro Tourist?
Sure. I'm a former equity derivative trader that worked at a big Canadian bank in the 90s. And I traded for the bank's balance sheet. And then when I was kind of at the birth of my first child, I kind of had this moment where I realized that I wasn't having as much fun and I wanted to spend a little time with the family. So I went and I quit. And I went home and I thought to myself, well, you know what? I'm going to give trading for myself a try. And I thought, if worst comes to worst, I can always go get a job. Well, 1 year turned into two, which turned into five, which turned into 20. And for the past 20 years, I've been trading my own account and doing a few other things on the side in terms of managing some money recently at another shop. But I'm back doing what I just love to do, which is to trade. And one of the things that while I was doing that, I had an office of myself and another trader, and we were just trading our own money, and we had it was kind of boring. So what I started to do was I started to write myself a journal, because good traders are always encouraged to write journals, and I started posting it on the internet just for something to do, you know, for kicks and giggles. And next thing I knew, I had some of my friends reading it, and I'd meet people downtown, and they'd say, "Hey, you know, I really enjoy your posts." And I realized that there was a real kind of benefit to putting my ideas out there and sharing it with the world, because people were writing me with some ideas back. And next thing I, you know, turned into a real business, and I love doing it because it ends up being a lot of fun, and I get to meet wonderful people like you across the world and chat about markets.
Yeah, and I find as well, I do a lot of writing as well, and I find that the discipline of having to explain it to somebody, often I start writing something where I think, right, I'm going to explain to people why they're completely wrong on this, and I get halfway through and I'm like, actually, you know what? Maybe it's me.
If you want to really know a subject, you have to teach it.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. Exactly. So, yeah, no, very much with you there. Cool.
Okay. Well,
so we might jump, and that was, I think that's where we sort of got introduced to your stuff, and in particular, I think we've got some very similar ideas on the need for governments to actually sort of get out and start spending money and not relying on monetary policy. But I think our conclusions are differing, and so that's where I want to try and jump a little bit into where the differences are there. But I might let you do a quick sort of background on sort of how you see the last few cycles, and what I guess in terms of what you've seen the primary drivers of sort of markets, I guess, sort of leading into the financial crisis and following the financial crisis, just to sort of set the scene for the conversation we're going to have.
For sure. I guess one thing I would say is for the longest time I was definitely a traditionalist in terms of my economic thinking. I was a gold bug. I thought to myself that this is going to end in inflation. And I thought that the threats of the double deficits were going to be ruin us all. And I was very much kind of a zero hedge kind of disciple and ate that stuff up hook, line, and sinker. As I went through and I realized that it wasn't working for me, it wasn't making me any money being a prophet of doom, expecting it always to collapse. And one of the things that I've kind of really been forced to think about is how the economy works and how the modern system that we are in right now operates. And I guess if we kind of go through it here, one of the realizations that I've come to is the fact that monetary policy, although it has been the primary tool of the central banks and the governments to stimulate the economy, has its limitations. And up until 2008, it seemed to be the only tool that we knew. Each time we got into trouble, the central bank came to the rescue, whether it be in the dot-com bubble with the Greenspan coming in and lowering rates to the unheard of 1% at that time and managing to re-liquefy the economy and kind of prop it back up. And then we got into a situation in 2008 when basically we had the great financial crisis and Bernanke tried to do the same thing. And not only did he lower rates to zero, he found that that wasn't enough and he actually was forced to go ahead and try to do to stimulate beyond zero. And he introduced something to us, which was quantitative easing, which was previously unheard of. I've watched this and, you know, at the time that Bernanke did that quantitative easing, I too thought there would be all sorts of inflation. I thought this was going to end with, in a fiery explosion of inflation that bankrupt us all. And much to my surprise, it didn't happen. And I've been struggling and trying to figure out why. And I think I've come to some conclusions about that. And I suspect that this is where we're going to talk a little bit about monetary modern theory, money theory and things of that nature. But I guess if we wanted to look at what I think's happened in the last little while in terms of the markets and we get a little more specific, I'd like to just kind of chat about what this last cycle's looked like in this past year and a half. Up until Powell was put into place as the head of the Federal Reserve, we had two very dovish central bank leaders in terms of at the Federal Reserve. It was both Bernanke and Yellen. And if you go look at the TIPS, two-year real the yield on the TIPS, which is basically the real yield, not taking into account inflation, you'll see
that these are the inflation inflation-protected bonds. So basically, you get
correct.
Your bond
so
yield.
It's the real yield inflation that an investor should expect after inflation. And you'll see that the two-year TIP between the point of the great financial crisis and up until Powell was brought in as the head of the Federal Reserve, it varied. It went between minus 150 basis points and 50 basis points. And it was quite a long period of either having negative real yields, which is, financial repression, or at the very minimum, just slightly positive real yields. And remember back, we had Bernanke try to pull it off zero. He couldn't do it. Yellen finally got us off zero. But even then, she did only one hike and then very quickly fell back down. Fast forward, we get Powell comes into kind of as the leader of the Federal Reserve. And he says to himself, I remember 2008. I remember how painful it was cleaning this all up. The one thing I want to do is I want to make sure that we don't have another bubble under my watch. So very quickly, he starts hiking rates. And if you go look at that two-year tip yield, it rallied from 50 basis points when he took it all the way up to 200. So he just kept cranking rates. Now, why was he able to do that? He was able to do that because at the same time, we had Trump doing fiscal stimulus. Trump came in, and even though we were 8 years into an economic cycle, and even the Keynesians would be telling you at this point you should be paying back the debt and trying to run surpluses, he came in and did fiscal stimulus. Well, this made the economy run hot. Not only that, they were the only country in the world that was running a fiscal stimulus. So money was attracted to the states, caused the U.S. dollar to rally, and Powell was petrified that we were going to have another bubble under his watch. So he started raising rates to slow down the economy. Unfortunately, what it did was it slowed down the whole global economy. So we had Trump spending money coming to the states, the dollar going up, and then make it even worse, we had Powell raising rates. And this was causing extreme pain throughout the world. Because let's face it, the U.S. is the reserve currency of the world, and basically liquidity was getting siphoned off to the rest of the world and getting it sent to the states. Until we finally hit that period in December, December is when he finally capitulated, but it was actually September that Powell made the grave mistake of saying we were a long way from zero, or a long way from neutral, meaning that he was going to continue tightening policy. And at that point, it was too much. The market very quickly rolled over. We had a period of 2 months when the stock market went down. There was all sorts of pain. Crude oil went down. Everything rolled over at the same time. There was two intense months of selling until finally Powell capitulated and cried uncle after Trump lambasted him. And what I think is interesting now is that we're in a situation where basically, he's not only taken back all of his hikes that he did, but he's actually hit a point where he's setting up the future Fed he's signaling that we're no longer going to be hawkish like that again. And I think you see that with him saying that they can overshoot on inflation. So now we have an interesting point where the Fed is saying that they won't do that again. They're probably the last central bank that's ever going to try to fight the back of inflation ever again. And we have a realization that the monetary stimulus that everyone used to think would cause all sorts of inflation that never did. Finally, the rest of the world is waking up to the fact that it's really not monetary stimulus that drives inflation, but fiscal stimulus. And we have to talk a little bit about Europe because I think they're the epicenter of all the problems. In terms of while everyone else was trying, in the States was doing all this fiscal stimulus and trying to run their economy stronger, the Europeans, instead of actually going and following suit, they tried to fix it through even lower monetary stimulus, like your monetary rates. And in doing that, they actually caused their economy more pain than strength. And I think that this is really the question and the heart of the matter is that we've finally hit the point where central banks have realized that they can no longer stimulate economies and that they have to step aside and it's governments that have to do it with fiscal policy. Yeah. And in setting this all up, I just don't think that I kind of look forward to me. And I think that the decades to come, we're going to have more and more fiscal policy and that there'll be very little monetary pushback from the central banks.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I've been saying is, from a big picture look, if you look at what central banks have done over the last 20, 30, 40 years, really what they've got their one lever, interest rates up, interest rates down, and for most of that, until the last sort of few years. But really what's happened is interest rate down means debt stops growing but doesn't shrink. Debt increases. Interest rate up means debt stops growing but doesn't shrink, but they still haven't worked out how to get people to actually deleverage. Like it sort of seems as if you keep bringing forward demand and so you get stuck at that point where you can only build up debt so far, and then your economy, everyone's got heaps and heaps of debt. So when you don't have any scope to increase your debt when you start lowering your rates. Because you go, well, we've already borrowed 80% of the value of our house or whatever on average in the economy.
Right. But this is, I guess this is where I differ from a lot of people, because I am 100% in your camp that private sector, whether it be corporations or individuals, have debt restriction limits. That there's only so much you can lend, meaning you can borrow, and there's no doubt that they will hit a wall, just like we saw in 2008 in the America. I think Canada is in the midst of hitting a wall right now. I know your country, you guys have slowed down on the debt binge and your housing rolled over. But I think governments are different. And governments, and we can talk a little bit about this, because everyone says, no, but Japan and all these things. But the reality is that they are not financially constrained as much as we think they are. And that the next kind of round of inflation will be as people realize that there isn't the constraints that everyone used to believe there was.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the ones I'd sort of jump on is Japan. Yes, you get that, whatever it is, 250-something percent of GDP. But then when you strip out what central bank owns, it brings you right back to just sort of 60% of GDP that the government debt is. So, yeah, if you're on your own printing press.
So you're absolutely correct. I think Japan is always the poster child when people tell me MMT hasn't worked. And I always say, first of all, MMT hasn't even been done yet, because Japan didn't do MMT. They're the farthest thing from MMT. All Japan is extreme monetarism, because the reality is every time their economy gets going, they try to raise taxes. So they're constantly trying to balance their budget on every single rally. But your point about the fact that basically we have this short position at the government level, meaning they have 250% of GDP is outstanding as debt. But then on the long side, the central bank, the BOJ, owns, I thought the number was 125. Like, I thought that basically they owned half of it, but it doesn't matter. The reality is that you have this long on one side, the short on the other side. And if you basically, like, let's just ask ourselves, if they went in the middle of the night and just kind of ripped up those two, you know, took the long and the short and flattened it and didn't tell anyone, would anything really change in the economy? Like, I would contend nothing would change in the economy.
Yep, I'm with you 100% on that.
And then if nothing would change in the economy, what's stopping them from doing it again with it, like spending that 125% again? And now then you're going to say, but wait, that can't be. That's inflationary. And I completely agree. Eventually it is inflationary. And it's that point.
But it hasn't been for 25 years.
That's right.
It hasn't been for 25 years.
It's that point that we need to get to. And as people realize that the governments have way more room than we think, and that they can spend until they create inflation, then all of a sudden the narrative is going to switch at a dime. I think it's hilarious that everyone is worried about deflation and tells me how they should buy long bonds. And I always ask them, how many countries do you know that have had collapsed because of deflation? I can't name a single one. I'd love someone to tell me like a country that's collapsed because of deflation. But I sure know a lot of countries that collapsed because of inflation. And I think that we are going to look back and it's going to be absurd that we were ever worried that we weren't able to create inflation. Because if there's a will, the governments will be able to spend. And they will just keep spending. And let's face it, if you actually look through the mechanics of it, they don't even need to borrow. They can just spend and not even issue bonds, which I know is really kind of crazy to like sounding. But this is the reality of the situation, is that they're currency issuers. And eventually they're limited by rules, but those rules are all self-imposed. So I really believe that most people are vastly underestimating the potential for inflation over the next few decades.
So that's sort of coming back to that whole point, isn't it? That, you know, in the end, we've got these economies that are producing all these goods and have capacity to produce a lot more and employ a lot more people. The real issue is we're just having this problem about how do we divide up the spoils, so to speak, because all the spoils keep going to one set of people, and all these other people keep building up this debt. And then we're saying, well, the whole system's going to, you know, how do we get this to stop? And they're saying, well, we need to work out how to get that inflation back into the system so that the people, the workers, the lower paid workers actually get some wage increases and starting to flow through to actually let them pay down their debt.
Right. But I would argue, Kevin, monetary stimulus is actually exacerbating the wealth inequality. and that everyone would be way better off with fiscal stimulus. And, you know, even if we didn't want to do fiscal stimulus, because some of my libertarian friends give me a hard time about my policies about this, and they say government can't do anything right. They screw it all up. And I go, okay, well, listen, how about this? Instead of the government going and spending more, how about they tax less? I don't know where your tax rate starts. Like in Canada, I think the first 12,000 or something is free. You don't pay tax on. I don't know what the number is. But instead of...
That's about 20.
Yeah. But all of a sudden, imagine you made it 30. It's not until 30,000 that you get taxed. So like
or you send the central bank. Yeah, well, that would give everyone a check for $1,000.
That's right. Well, see, I don't even know if you have to send it out. Like this is the point where I love to talk about MMT because I think MMT guys get a lot right. I think where MMT goes wrong or people interpreting correctly is that I like to divide MMT up into a descriptive part and a prescriptive part. The descriptive part is how a modern monetary system works. That's a fiat based system. And then the prescriptive part is based upon that understanding, what are you going to do about it? And people think that...
Yep. Actually, sorry. Can we just take one step back before you launch too far? Just for the people who don't know about MMT. So MMT is modern monetary theory and basically is a theory that you can... And actually, I probably should throw to you, given you've written a lot of the basis of it. Let me throw to you for the quick description. I'm just otherwise, reading for what you've written.
But Kevin, a quick one, actually. Just before we move into the MMT field, I'm just reflecting back on what's effectively been a global monetary policy experiment, ex-Japan, of course, as we mentioned there, has gone a lot longer. From your experience, just how effective do you think loose monetary policy really is on coalface commercial decisions?
Oh, I think it's like zero. There's a Goldman Sachs report that went and looked at the corporations, a company's willingness to borrow based upon changes in interest rates. And I think for the 80s and 90s, it was somewhat negatively correlated, meaning that if I got this right, rates go up and they'll borrow less. Yeah. And so rates go down, they would borrow more. It was somewhat loosely negatively correlated. But I think since the 2000 and 2010, the correlation is gone and is in fact gone now positively correlated, meaning that as rates go down, a company's willing to borrow less. And if you think about it, let's just kind of like I saw the Deutsche Bank CEO the other day saying something to the effect of, please don't go and lower rates another 25 basis points. My clients aren't any more willing to borrow because you've gone from minus 50 to minus 75. And let's just kind of think about if you're a CFO or a CEO of a large multinational company and you're thinking about doing some CapEx spending, you're thinking about making a new plant. Well, is the real problem that extra 25 basis points? Probably not. Your real problem is you build a plant and nobody is there to buy any of the products that you want to build. So that with
and your other problems, you're screwing your banks. So your banks now have got less willingness to lend because they're making less of a margin because they've
well not only the banks less willing to lend, the companies are less willing to lend because the whole economy has less kind of chips around going around. There's less demand. So the real problem is we need to have the demand needs to be fixed. And I call myself kind of I envelop myself in a little bit of the monetary an MMT guy. But the reality is that a lot of the kind of the way I've always thought about markets and the economy has been MMT consistent. And I'll take us back to the great financial crisis. Like I remember when they took rates down to zero and then they were saying they're going to buy bonds. And I said, listen, bonds are already gone bid through the roof because everyone's reaching for them. The last thing we need is the government to be competing for those bonds. What we really need is the government to be issuing bonds and going out and spending the money. So I always said that why doesn't the government go out in like 2008? What they should have done, instead of going and trying to buy bonds, they should have issued, I don't know what the number would have been, 50 billion or whatever the number needed to be of like 100-year paper at like 2%. And then put fiber to everyone's home, go fix all the bridges, do productive things with the money that you can borrow at these low rates. I think it's hilarious the fact that the German Bund is trading at minus 30 basis points or whatever it is. That means that the German government can spend money and actually make money on their, like they can, as long as they don't lose 30 basis points for the next 10 years, they're actually up on the transaction. Yeah, they're getting paid to invest.
Yeah, I've got a chart I put out all the time, which is I track the yield on the German bonds, where, you know, it's 4% pre-crisis, where people are saying, "Oh, we'll charge you 4% to borrow money from us," and then, you know, a few years later, they're like, "Tell you what, I'll give it to you for half price, you know, 2% if you just get out and borrow money from me." And then they're like, "Okay, what about I give it to you for nothing? I'll give you for nothing." And now they're at the stage of saying, "I will pay you to get out and spend money." And they're still saying, no, austerity.
It's crazy. And you know, the other thing that I think is funny is if, imagine they did go out and imagine when the governments were spending too much money and we had inflation and the bond market was going no bid, like it was collapsing and we had a really steep yield curve. Everyone would be screaming and saying, look at what the signals the bond market are telling you. Look at what the bond market is saying. The bond market is saying that you guys are spending too much money. What I think is funny is that when it goes the other way, when the bond market goes like absolutely crazy to the, you know, upside, nobody's stopping and thinking, hey, wait, maybe the problem is that the governments aren't spending too much, are not spending enough money that way. And I know that's kind of perverse to think about, but.
Yeah. But do you think that's because, you know, we ran through the 70s and with all these inflation problems, and so we put on all these rules to say, let's put these rules to make sure this never happens again. And because the problem was always politicians going to spend too much. If you give them the chance, they're going to spend way too much. But we've added so many rules now, we've actually swung the pendulum so far the other way that now they're all scared to spend. And we're sort of sitting in this other part where we've, as you said, we need to start taking some of the rules off and saying, no, come on, guys, get out and spend that money.
No, you're absolutely correct. And not only have we put rules, but we've also convinced everyone that this debt is burdening our future, you know, our children. The Japanese actually think that their children are going to have to pay off 250% of the GDP, where the reality is that the Bank of Japan already owns half of it. There's not, you know, there's that debt is already half of what they think it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so let's jump into your quick summary of what MMT is.
MMT, I like to say it centers around the idea that the currency issuers, meaning governments that issue in their own currency and don't borrow in another currency, are never financially constrained. They are real resource constrained. And the example that I like to give that's the kind of the easiest one to think about is when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, do you think that the U.S. government went out and said, you know, we're going to have to make all these ships, we're going to have to make all these rifles and tanks and stuff to go into this war. We better check if the bond market is going to let us, you know, borrow that much. They didn't. The reality is that they just went and started spending. And there's always money. The government, like a currency issuer, can always spend money. Now, eventually, when they spend money, they will create inflation. And this is like people will say, whoa, on your example, there was war bonds. Those war bonds were used to pay off the war. Well, actually, they weren't. The war bonds were actually created to basically change private sector behavior. Because if you think about it from a government point of view, if you're trying to get every single piece of metal that you can into, you know, to go to the war effort, to, you know, be used in the things you need for the war, and every single hour of labor, you know, to build those ships and stuff, the last thing you need is some guy feeling, you know, wealthy and buying himself a new Buick. So what you do is you go and you entice him to buy a bond so that he doesn't go in and spend his money. So the government doesn't have to compete for real resources. So this is the end result is that you have to realize that a government is constrained by the real resources, not by net financial resources. So this idea, this Reinhardt and Rogoff idea that we hit this wall and that the governments can't keep spending is kind of is bunk, in my opinion. And not only that,
if you've got your own currency.
Pardon me, sorry.
If you've got your own currency.
If you have your own currency.
Because if you're reliant
you're
on
You're absolutely
people,
correct.
If you're reliant on other countries.
Go and say, look, Argentina's an example of MMT that didn't work. That is not the case. Like that is not an example of MMT. There really hasn't been an example. Mm. But regardless of whether you believe in MMT or not, I always like to say that our jobs as traders or investors is to figure out what is as opposed to what should be. So if everyone sits around, and I don't like to focus too much on arguing how the world should be arranged, because let's face it, everyone has an opinion. It doesn't matter too much. What our job is to figure out how it's going to be arranged. And so when I look at the writing on the wall and I see these young people and I see that them starting to understand MMT and the MMT movement gaining ground, I look at it and I say the tide is shifting. We are now becoming more willing to have governments go and spend. We just had an election in Canada, 6 months ago, and there wasn't a single politician that made a big deal about the deficits. It was like our kind of right wing guy tried to make a big deal about it, and he realized it was a losing battle. And I think this is more and more where we're going. Let's face it, Trump came. Trump is a Republican president. What did he do? He made the deficit as big as it's ever been. And so there's a few holdouts still. Europe has been one of them. And I would argue that the reason that Europe's economy is so bad is because they keep trying to fix everything with monetary stimulus instead of fiscal stimulus.
Australia's another one. We've just had they just came out with a budget update today where they're cutting back spending because iron ore revenues are falling.
Yeah. They're doing pro-cyclical cuts. You know, one of the charts that I love bringing up is this idea about Obama. And everyone talks about Obama being the spendthrift president that, ballooned the deficits. And what they fail to realize is that a lot of those deficits were created from the result of automatic stabilizing programs, whether it be welfare or unemployment insurance. And when you go look at the federal U.S. federal government spending, the year-over-year change, and if you pull up a chart for the past 50 years of that federal government spending, up until the Great Financial Crisis, there was 3 years when it fell year-over-year. I think it was 64, 68, and then in 95 or something. I think Clinton might have done one. So 3 years out of 40. There was, we had year over year spending decreases on a discretionary basis for the government, for the federal budget. Then Great Financial Crisis hits. What happens? We have 5 years in a row of them cutting that budget deficit. And this is the problem. They did the same thing. They went and did pro-cyclical cuts at a time when the government needed to be spending, not cutting back. And so if you guys are doing that as well, then it's very clear to me that your economy will most likely suffer going forward, even though it's your right wing party that won, right? Am I correct?
Yeah. So their plan is to get house prices. So they're basically Australia's been through the process where the courts came out and said the banks are lending irresponsibly. They got to stop. And then as soon as this guy got voted, he wound back a lot of conditions and he's lending more money. He's letting new home buyers borrow 95%. So his basic plan is if he can get house prices going, then everything else will sort itself out. And so part of it looks like he's not spending money just so the central bank has to keep cutting rates.
So he's basically putting the back on the consumers. They're the only ones that are going to basically be able to create money. Because that money is created when they go and borrow money to buy houses. And so...
And meanwhile, housing construction is cratering. Housing construction is actually cratering. So it's a unique experiment.
It is.
Can just housing prices on their own drive the rest of the economy?
Well, here in Canada, we were bad at this as well. We did the same thing as you guys in that we went, and what happened was after the Great Financial Crisis, not only did we have a situation where our banks were able to go lend to the consumer, our consumer hadn't borrowed as much as the Americans. And then we had the double problem of the immigration, not a problem. It is in a lot of ways, it's a good thing, but we had a lot more immigration into Canada because America tightened their borders and tightened a lot of different things. So we all of a sudden had just a huge influx, and we've created a bubble that's like epic. It's just as bad as yours. And one of the things is that it'll be interesting to see once this rolls over, how our economy is going to be able to deal with it, because it's just been our only real source of growth.
Yeah. Let's get to that in a minute, because I want to talk some of the differences between Australia and Canada. The thing I did, so you've spoken a lot about the real thing in terms of fiscal policy, that the issue I have is in terms of timing. So I'm with you on the whole part about it needs to be done, or it's the only way of getting out of this. You know, you can, the main ways you get debt down is you can have sort of debt jubilees where everyone gets their debt sort of written off, and we haven't done that for a couple hundred years, and it doesn't look like anytime soon that's going to happen. The companies that have made the loans can take big write downs and take the losses. People go bankrupt, companies go bankrupt. The financial crisis, everything that could get bailed out once Lehman had gone under, got bailed out. So it looks like nobody's going to do that. So it really looks like the only way left we have is this inflation. But as you said, governments are still, they seem wary to do it. And there doesn't seem to have been a sea change. So I think you're right, this is where we're going. But it's this question of saying, well, what happens though if the next party gets in and we all end up like Japan, where we just keep, you know, spending a little bit more money and then giving it to the central bank, and so you don't actually get that sort of MMT spending money for free, so to speak.
So I completely agree. This is where this is kind of the weakness of my argument, is that we convince ourselves that the debt is real and that we don't go ahead and spend, and in doing so we make it worse, and we have kind of a lost decade or two like Japan did, and we just kind of keep trudging through. Why I don't think this will happen, first of all, have a look at the U.S. The U.S. is already running, 4.1. It's kind of hilarious that Germany is giving Italy all sorts of guff about their about their deficit. Do you know what Italy's deficit is?
Is it two or three?
It's 2.5. Yeah. It's 2.5, yeah. And America's running 4.1. So the reality is that the big leading countries like America are already going and doing that. I think that everyone's going to look at America and say, why is their economy doing so strong? They're starting to realize that monetary policy is ineffective. And not only that, not only is it ineffective, I think it actually becomes counterproductive as it approaches zero and then as it goes negative. I would argue that as you go more and more negative, you cause more and more pain. And in fact, you're slowing the economy, not helping it. I say if I was running Europe, if I was a benevolent dictator and I could run Europe, I would instantly raise rates to 100 basis points from minus 50 or whatever it is. And I would cut taxes and spend on the government side until the economy balanced. And I think that and the reason that when I used to talk about this a year or two ago, everyone told me I was nuts. And now all of a sudden, more and more people are kind of in my camp. You see Ray Dalio becoming very consistent with these kind of messages. Even all the central bankers, when you talk to them, and I have some buddies that kind of go in and talk in those circles, they are quietly admitting that they realize that they no longer can simulate the economy and that it's up to the fiscal side. And then you combine.
Yes. And so the question I have, though, coming back to that, is do they need a crisis to actually focus their mind and go, okay? Because it's sort of, if things aren't bad, like things are obviously bad at the moment, the growth is very low at the moment, but it's still positive in most of these countries. Do they actually need a crisis so that they actually sit back and have some self reflection to then go, okay, let's try something different?
I've got an excuse, really.
Well, yeah.
Or can they do it without that crisis?
I think they can do it without the crisis, but this is the point to me that's up in the air, like the debatable point. I'm sympathetic to the argument that we're not going to get real change until we get that crisis. So there's no doubt that maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we're going to need one last swoosh before they really bring in the crazy policies. But, everyone talks about the boomers and they talk about they're the biggest cohort of, part of the generation. That's not true. If you actually look, there's more millennials than there are boomers right now, at least in America. I don't know what it's like in Australia, and I think we're the similar. I think you're going to find that just at the margin, we're going to get changes in policies and changes in attitude. And I think you're going to find that governments are going to be less willing to to go out and try to balance budgets. And in doing so, just bit by bit, we're going to continue to spend. And you're going to see changes in attitude, like the fact that we have the Federal Reserve already saying that they're willing to let it run over 2% for an extended period of time. These are really kind of wholesale changes. And I think it might just sneak up on you. You'll just see all of a sudden it get there. You know, I thought that Europe wasn't spending. And then I had a good buddy that showed me the fiscal account for Germany, Greece, France, and some big things. And they're actually running, they're increasing their spending. So yeah, maybe it's not going to be some sort of grand plan like an Eisenhower, build all sorts of roads. But it could just be that at the margin, everyone starts spending. And at the same time, the central banks say, hey, we're not going to raise rates to offset that. And next thing you know, it just kind of takes off. So I don't know the timing either, but I'm not as sure that you need the crisis that everyone thinks you're going to need
to get there.
Yeah. I do think if somebody can just explain the situation correctly to Trump that, hey, here's some free money if you just frame the words right, that it seems he would be a willing spender of money.
Do you don't think he'd already figured that out, though?
Well, I'm saying if he could launch his, I do think he's figured out that the more money he spends, the better. But I think if he could have an economic fig leaf to cover spending even more money.
Oh, like he'd go really crazy. Like he would do 8 or something. Like he'd double it. Yeah, you know what? You're probably right. That's probably true. Yeah.
Like that'd be, that's how you get all your infrastructure built, is he's saying, look, no longer do deficits not matter, but spending doesn't matter. Yeah. And, you know.
No, anyway. you're probably right. That is probably, because that guy, let's face it, he's a kook. Like if he could do it, he'd probably do it.
I guess he's not an economic traditionalist, you'd say.
I don't know if you put you'd put economic in front of that. I think you just go traditionalist in any way.
Okay, and so your take to play this is inflation-linked bonds. So do you want to give us a little bit of your background? Is that
I love it. It's my favorite trade for the next decade, and I'll go through it. I believe that we are going to have a sustained rise of inflation. As I said, I think we're going to look back and laugh about the idea that we couldn't create it. And what I think will happen is that there are other ways to play it, in that you can buy gold, but that's a derivative of inflation. It might or might not go with inflation, and it's complicated. I'd rather own something just pure inflation, because I think that we're going to have a period where the last 20, 30 years have seen Wall Street win over Main Street. I suspect that Main Street's going to start winning over Wall Street. And I think that basically we're going to have a situation where financial assets struggle, and that inflation does better. Like, I think if you go look at corporate profits as a percentage of the economy versus wages as a percentage of the economy, you'll see the corporate profits have been going straight up and wages have been going straight down. And here's another thing that we haven't talked about this so far. We've only spoken about the fiscal side. I think there's also a very dramatic other piece of the puzzle when it comes to inflation that we haven't mentioned, which is the fact that in 1989, there was the China basically came into the WTO, and also the fall of the Berlin Wall. Those two things caused a huge avalanche of labor into the kind of developed economy. And so since then, we've all been struggling with the fact that labor has just gotten less and less as this globalization has occurred. And we've had a situation where, you know, if a company starts complaining, or you know, the workers start complaining about how much they're making, the company just takes it out and moves it to China. And so there's been this huge dramatic push on this. Well, I think we've hit the kind of the nadir of globalization, and we're actually headed the other way. And I would say that, again, Trump was a perfect example of somebody that kind of changed the narrative. And he started to call out China and call out the abuses and call out all these things. And I think globalization is headed the other way for the next, you know, couple of decades. And if you think about what globalization brought, it brought lower prices and it brought lower interest rates. And I think at the very least, you're going to see a situation where you have higher prices and higher interest rates as globalization is reversed. So go back to my trade. Why? So I think you should buy inflation-linked bonds, and I don't think you should just buy them outright, because my problem is I'm a huge Kodiak grizzly of a bear on interest rates. Bonds, because I think bonds are going to get absolutely kind of just like schmucked. Like they're going to get just destroyed as interest rates rise, especially the long end. So I think what you need to do is you need to own TIPS, which is Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, and short out the interest rate components so that you're basically left with just the inflation. And so what you're doing is that's called buying the break-even, which means that you're buying the inflation rate. And if you look at long-term break-evens, you'll see that they're actually below the Fed's mandated rate. Like I'll go and just pull up like the break-even for the 10-year in the U.S., The U.S. 10-year is now 1.71%. That means that the market is forecasting that the Fed is not going to be able to hit their inflation rate. And so even if we go a little bit longer and we look at the 30-year break-even tonight is also right there. It's 1.76. It's also below the rate of inflation, of their kind of mandated inflation rate. So I think you're going to see a situation where those inflation rates are going to go through the roof. I could very easily see those going doubling or tripling to 4 or 5%. And I think that owning break-evens is the best way to kind of institute that trade. And another thing I worry about kind of going forward is that I worry about kind of the publics and the not just the public, the professional investor as well, their reliance on the negative correlation between stocks and bonds saving them in their portfolio. What I mean by that is a lot of times, when you make a construct a portfolio, you'll say, I'm going to own some risky assets like stocks, but I'm also going to put in some bonds. And the good thing about bonds are that when my stocks go down, that means that there's going to be something going wrong and the low interest rates are going to be going lower. So therefore, my bonds will be going up in price. And this has been an absolute great trade. You could see guys like the richest hedge fund manager in the world, Ray Dalio, he basically made his living off of something called risk parity, which enabled him to lever up a large bond portfolio along with his stocks. I worry that that is something that works in a disinflationary environment, and that as we enter into an inflationary environment, stocks and bonds will go back to being positively correlated. And the thing that everyone thinks that'll save them in their portfolio, meaning the bonds, that will actually be the anchor that drags them down.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we do a lot of asset allocation with our client portfolios, and that's exactly what we play off those. And the thing that keeps me up at night is exactly what you're saying, is if we move to an inflationary environment, then the bonds are cooked. But I guess it's that point about when we move. And so that's I'm busy looking at signs, that politics is moving towards that. And I can see that incremental one you're talking about. But I guess I'm not quite sure if there's another crisis to come yet. And that's where, say the Canadian bonds are, that your bond yields are among the highest in the developed world. And I guess that's where, and Australia's a fair bit lower, but, we're sort of sitting in a similar camp, I guess, in two sort of small commodity dependent economies, is that it's whether is there another leg down or another, do you have a couple of years where if we do go down the Japan route, is you do want to keep owning those bonds? And so, I guess it comes back to that question of timing.
I hear you. It feels to me like picking the nickel up in front of the steamroller.
Mm.
I think there's better things to own. I'll tell you one interesting thing. We have a big pension fund in Canada here, and they divide up their asset class, and they divide it up. You'll see their stocks, bonds, real assets, meaning things like, real estate, infrastructure, and things like that. And then they have a fourth one that they call inflation. Mm. And I was hugely kind of interested in this, and I looked at it, and they treat inflation like an asset class, and they are long 10% of their portfolio in these inflation break-even trades.
Mm.
Meaning they don't own TIPS. They own TIPS and are short bonds. So they're isolating out just the inflation portion of it.
Yeah.
Because to me, I don't see anything else out there. If we get into this situation that what I'm talking about, I don't know what else saves you apart from this trade. Yeah, gold might work. I'm not going to deny that. But I just, there's nothing to me that seems as certain to be a hedge for what I'm worried about as this inflation break even.
Yeah.
And here's something else I had to tell you about. I often say, you know, when people tell me, oh, I wish I was around in the dot-com crisis. Or the dot-com bubble. It was so easy to call that. It was so obvious it was going to go down. Mm. Or even the younger traders that say, I wish I was around 2008. Boy, that was so easy. I would have been like the big short. Mm. You know, I was in both of those bubbles. And I can tell you, when you're in a bubble, nobody really thinks they're in a bubble. And everyone, if it was a bubble and it was so obvious, it wouldn't be a bubble.
Well, as well. Yeah.
And that's the part that everyone misses, right?
Yeah, I was in the same bit. And, you know, you've looked at a stock that's up 50% and you're like, oh, I'm selling that thing. That's, you know, how expensive is that now?
Yeah.
And a year later, it's up 1,000%. And you're looking at all this money you've left on the table. And then 2 years after that, it's well below what you sold it at. So you're like, well, I was right, but it really, really, really hurt for 2 years.
Right. And the thing is that while that was happening, everyone was telling you were an idiot if you were saying it was a bubble.
Oh, absolutely. Hey.
Right. And so this is my point, is that this is what I worry about with all the people trying to call for a deflationary collapse. And the other thing I've learned is that the next bubble never looks like the last bubble.
Yes.
I'm more worried about it exploding to the upside in terms of inflation and it looking nothing like this last kind of deflationary collapse.
Mm. Yeah. And the big,
that's my two cents. Like I could be wrong. You know, my dad tells me the story of his father was around in the great depression. And he remembers the fact that everyone with a mortgage and a house got just absolutely annihilated. So he never bought a house.
Mm.
So like there, his whole life he rented a house because he was always worried about the fact that it was going to collapse. To me, that feels a little bit like stocks these days.
Yeah. And having said that, you know, I'm assuming, you know, given the way the Canadian housing market gone, it's probably pretty similar to Australia, where you've got the opposite, where everyone's like, oh no, I bought a house in 1970 or 1980 with X percent of my income and inflation just carried me up and look at all this money I made from it, and houses never lose. And so you get that real,
right?
You know, I guess people here tend to go, well, yeah, I know they fell in America or somewhere like that, and Ireland and Spain, but those places are a long way away from here. House prices here keep going up. And you're like, yeah. So.
Okay. Very good.
We might, given interest of time, and I know it's quite late there for you.
Yeah. Look, thanks very much, Kevin, for your time here today. It's a great chat.
It was my pleasure. It was great chatting with you guys. Can I just ask quickly what you guys think is going to happen to your kind of economy and stock market?
I love trading,
and I'm always interested in hearing what people on the ground are saying about their own kind of economy.
Yeah, we're trying to get as much as we can out of Australia. So we're at sort of minimum weight in most of our portfolios. I guess the issue we've got is very much that we've got this. We're well in front of you in terms of the stages of debt. We've managed to gear up as much as possible. We are going to try and gear up a bit more into next year. So we've got some new first home buyers. But in the meantime, everything else is falling apart. And the government doesn't seem to
current government
doesn't seem to realize that they need to get out and spend money. And they think that the hallmark of a good manager is giving. Is coming up with surpluses, and I think they're a bit. They sort of found that. Well, look at what we did in the 2000s. You know, we basically pulled back a bit on spending, and then a housing boom saved us, and then China saved us, and then you know, all these other things happen. If we just do the same thing, we just pull back in spending and let everything else sort itself out, we'll be fine. And so, yeah, we're quite negative in terms of that. Not forward looking. We think as well the central banks been very much behind the curve. I mean, and they've even spoken about, they came out and said, oh, we're going to give this long term. They come out and give one statement that says we're going to keep rates low for a long, long, long time. And then they'll come out in another speech and give indications that they're going to be raising rates if a few things happen. So they haven't even got their messaging right. And I do feel
right.
We're just following down. Like, we should be in the best position because we're behind everyone else. We've seen Europe go through this. We've seen, Canada to a certain extent, but certainly the US go through this. We've seen what works and doesn't work. We should be going, well, let's try some of the stuff that does work, but also we need something new because this other stuff doesn't work. But they still seem to be very orthodox in terms of, well, let's just keep doing what everyone else did, you know, 5 years behind them.
Right.
Yeah.
And can I ask what you guys see in terms of you're closer to China and you're probably more in tune with what's happening there? What are your, what's your kind of outlook there?
In terms of China, yeah, look, I think the main thing we see is that we think there's been a step change in terms of the way companies are treating China in that, and this is quite a long story, but it's in terms of saying that you would never outsource your – a multinational company would never look at Russia and say, we will go and outsource our entire supply chain to Russia. Mm-hmm. And Russia's actually, you know, I know they're not a very good democracy, but they are actually a democracy versus China. It's a very different scenario where China somehow got itself into this position where people were just accepting that we'll outsource our entire supply chain. And we think now that that's now changed and that companies are actually genuinely looking and saying, well, if we're buying a bunch of new servers, you know, were they sourced in China? Do we need to worry about, you know, hacking? What are the – and we're just getting there's a lot of political influence from China in Australia and a lot of pushback against that. So there's this real sort of tension. And so our view is that China has sort of reached the limit in terms of that industrial side of its economy, that you're only going to see – quite a weak industrial side of that economy, and that to prop that up, they've been spending as much as they can on apartments, which is fantastic for the Australian economy in that it uses all this iron ore and coke and coal and all these other factors. But they came out in 2011 saying their economy was unbalanced and they were spending far too much on housing and all these types of things. And now their housing market, they're actually building almost double the amount they were in 2011. So we think that's reached the limit of where, or very close to the limit. So they can stimulate that area and keep stimulating, but they're pretty close to the limits in terms of they can't really grow it. Like once you're building whatever it is, X million dollars per year, if you want to grow, you need to build X plus one. And we think that's right. Sort of reaching the limit. So we're not bullish on China. We sort of feel as if there's a lot of growth issues there that they're facing, and plus debt issues. And Australia, we think of it really as second derivative on China. You know, our economy's houses and holes, as we like to call it. We dig stuff up, sell it to China, and then use it to bid our own house prices up. Mm. And so
I agree with that. So where do you hide then? What do you think?
Where are we going? Well, look, bonds has been great for us, but we're also doing a lot offshore in terms of looking for. I mean, US is always hard to, you know, US is obviously the most expensive market. We've found a fair bit of success in finding companies exposed to the US listed in other markets, especially Europe, sort of some of the peripherals. You can pick up companies that, you know, are 60-70% exposed to the US, but they happen to be listed in Europe, so you can pick them up, you know, 3 or 4 PE points cheaper.
Okay.
But the real key for us is that bond call is saying, well, if Australia is going to end up like everyone else because we're doing all the same economic policies as everyone else, then there's still more scope to run in that bond one. But
for sure. You have a government that's trying to, you know, balance the budget, I understand why you're worried about calling for a bond bear, because I always said that if I saw governments trying to balance books, I would be a lot less, I'd be more bullish on bonds than I am.
Yeah.
So if you're seeing that, then I completely understand that.
Yeah. So we're sort of waiting for that time to then go, right. Yeah. So we feel as if we've got no good choices at the moment. So cash, we've got lots of cash as well. Mm. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, it was a pleasure chatting with you guys. Yeah. Have a great day.
Thanks, Kevin. Just before you go, do you mind just filling in our listeners on where they can follow some of your work as well, if you like?
Oh, for sure. Go to, it's called themacrotourist.com, and you can sign up by, it's kind of, I'm writing more regularly again now. So I'm up to 4 or 5 times a week, and it's a free newsletter. Sign up and you can get it there, or you can follow me at Twitter at Kevin Muir, M-U-I-R.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thanks very much for your time today, and we look forward to getting on again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.
So, Damien, terrific. I think it was about an hour there spent with Kevin Muir, very smart guy, some strong views on whether or not he thinks inflation is back from the dead. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I pretty much already ran through our investment view at the end of that, so I won't get too much into depth, but I think certainly in terms of what Kevin's saying, one of the things we're really
looking at now is this global fiscal impulse. And it's something that we've sort of had in the back of our minds about following these. But, you know, following up that conversation, we're sort of doing a little bit of extra work and just sort of tracking that a little bit more closely. I do think we'll have some time on that one in terms of the, you know, the lead time. As you said, there's been a number of elections where they're looking to spend more money. So in England is a good example, mm-hmm. and Canada as well. Trump's obviously been spending money since he got in. Question is, he probably needs another round of it. But yep. And Lagarde's talking about extra spending, but it's not happening yet. Mm. So what? And fiscal spending does take a time to actually start until the rubber hits the road.
Yep.
So certainly something we need to be mindful of, and something we need to be watching. I do think we still have some more time on that. And the issue, as Kevin, you know, said himself as well, is if we've got a government here that's pulling back while we're sort of while everywhere else is pushing forward, then that probably just means a lower Aussie dollar and Australian bonds relative to elsewhere. You know, you've still got more time.
More time. Yep, sure.
Having said that, you know, there's probably a bit more of a maybe we play it a little bit further back down the curve, a little bit sort of more in the belly of the curve, where you do have a bit of a hedge in terms of if you've got the Australian economy pulling the front end down.
This is the bond yield.
The curve. Bond yield curve. Yeah, yep. The Australian economy pulling the front yield, the front end down, because we're just keeping rates on lower for longer.
Yep.
But internationally, if you start seeing bond yields start to rise, and maybe the long end actually gets carried a little bit or a little bit more. So yes, that's one sort of thing that comes out of that is worth thinking about. The inflation linked bonds. Look, I think that's good. I think that's a good trade. It's not one we're going to do because we don't short in our portfolio. So you need to find somebody who's going to go long short, and you do need to take relatively big swings at that if you want to get the if you actually want to get some returns
out of it.
So it's an interesting trade, and we've certainly been looking at inflation linked bonds. We've got a few in the portfolio.
We do.
And we're sort of working out when the right time to add more of them is. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, for us, that's not a trade we can do. I think, though, it is an interesting trade, and I think he'll be right over a, you know, 5 to 10 year period. Mm. The question is, if you're wrong for a shorter period, and also if you are going to do that trade, if you want to actually get meaningful returns out of it, you need to leverage and it's a long short call, and so it's not a typical
safe bond play.
No, that's right. but I do think he's on the right track there. And the biggest one I've sort of got up there on the screen as well is that, you know, do we need another crisis first before we get here? Now, I think, and I didn't pose this to him, but I'm sure Kevin would say yes. If we get another crisis, then, you know, that's an impetus to it.
Yep.
He's arguing we don't need a crisis. It's going to sort of naturally drift towards that. Mm-hmm. And I can see that, that might be a likely scenario, and that's why we wanted to get him on.
Yep.
But, you know, if you do get that crisis first, then you will see bond yields sort of go lower first before you then get that real change in terms of fiscal spending and people wanting to actually spend that.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, I hope you enjoyed that one, and we'll move across to what's coming up next week. So we're finishing up with a bang. We spoke to a doctor and also General Robert Spalding this week. He's just recently published a book called Stealth War, and had some revealing, perhaps quite shocking revelations, is probably the best way to put it, on his experiences in dealing with Chinese, living in China, and also then being an attaché and being a policy, advisor to the way that the Chinese have over time crept into the American way of life, and has some strong views as to whether or not this is a good thing.
And also been very senior in the Pentagon and very senior in the White House.
That's right.
So in terms of getting, a senior on the ground, boots on the ground type of person, he's sort of the perfect person to really get in and talk about what's happening in China. And we've obviously spoken a few times about issues in terms of China and companies turning away from it.
That's right.
For anyone at all involved in China, I think this is a must list, much watched. If there's anything you're going to watch this year, get into this one.
And just on that note as well, as an early Christmas present, we will be releasing that one on the 24th, so Tuesday the 24th of December, as opposed to our usual Thursday. We just thought we'd get in early, and for those that are looking for a fantastic podcast to listen to, then we'll make that available going forward from Tuesday the 24th. And on that note,
well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you with the next one. Cheers.